As you've no doubt just heard on the news, late this afternoon the Murray-Darling Basin Authority released its much-anticipated plan. The authority was set up in 2008 to take responsibility for the integrated management of the basin's water resources. The basin, which covers 14% of Australia's landmass, generates 40% of our income derived from agricultural production. It's home to more than 2 million people, and a further 1.3 million people, including the population of Adelaide, are reliant on its water resources. As expected, the plan calls for drastic cuts in water allocation to farmers. I'm now joined by two people who are deeply involved in the water allocation issue. Mick Keogh is the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute, which promotes policy solutions that maximise the economic and social well-being of farmers. And we're also joined by economist Professor Mike Young. He's Executive Director of the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide. He's also a member of the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists. Professor Mike Young, let's start with you. You spent the afternoon in the lockup in Canberra closely examining the plan. Can you spell out the plan's major recommendations?
Well, let me try and do it very simply. The most important one is a strong commitment to providing security. And as part of that, they're proposing that this plan, this new plan, can't be suspended if it goes wrong. So there's a real commitment to getting the detail right and locking us into a plan. In terms of the reduction, they're talking about a reduction of between 3,000 and 4,000 gigalitres in the average amount of water made available to users over the long term. How much is that? Depends on how you measure the cuts that have been talked about or the reductions. If the reduction is made only by acquiring water from surface irrigators, then it's between 27 and 37%. But they've put on the table a possibility to also involve reductions in forests, farm dams, overland flows. And if that's the case, then the impact on everybody would only be a 29% maximum reduction, so between 22 and 29. So they're really putting options on the table, talking about important reduction. What does this mean in terms of environmental benefits? It means that water will flow through the mouth and keep the mouth of the River Murray open 9 years in 10. They're saying now that at the moment it's about 6.5 years in 10. So about a third of the time the mouth is closed under the current regime. They're talking of taking it up so only 1 year in every decade you'd have the mouth closed. That's the minimum. And beyond that, most of the benefits of taking higher amounts go locally in each region. A very important debate to be had.
Now, Mike Young, are the cuts equal across the board, or are some regions and some valleys more affected than others?
It's not equal across the basin in the way they've modelled it. But something they have done is they've also proposed that from the start of the basin plan in 2012, the entire basin will be open to free trade. There won't be any more restrictions of the type you see at the moment in Victoria. So there'll be adjustment no matter what happens. But they've modelled it in terms of a region-by-region approach, and there are 21 regions in all their... There are 19 regions right across the basin that they've got detailed data in, and there's lots of numbers. People, I think, are going to make the mistake of arguing over the numbers rather than the big concepts, which are so important to get right.
Well, what are the impacts in terms of lost agricultural production and lost jobs?
In terms of lost jobs, they're actually much smaller than I had expected. They work out some net job impacts. The largest number is 1,200 jobs, which is about a 1% reduction across the board. And that assumes, when you look into the way the modelling's been done, that this change, which would be really significant, induces no innovation. That's across the board. Obviously, there are going to be some areas which are going to be severely affected and other areas will be hardly affected at all. What it does mean is that communities and businesses will have a sustainable future and will have much greater security.
And I think a figure of $1.1 billion in terms of a reduction in agricultural output, that's the figure in terms of lost income.
Yes, that's gross, and there's a big difference between gross and net, of course. There's a lot of debate around these numbers, and there's a lot more, but they're consistent with all of the modelling that's been done previously. I don't see any surprises in these numbers.
Well indeed, I've heard in the news that several people have said that, look, this is drastically underestimating the decline in jobs or the loss in jobs. Mick Keogh, if I can bring you in here, you're the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. What's your response to this plan?
Well, I think there's a whole range of issues, and it's a bit hard to sum them up in one, I suppose. I think the numbers in terms of reduction in water availability are certainly at the upper end of a lot of expectations of the farming sector. I think the impacts are a little bit underestimated in how they're expressed, because they talk about basin-wide jobs. And, of course, when you talk basin-wide, you talk about centres like Canberra and Toowoomba and those sorts of places being included. And that gives you a bit of a distorted picture, whereas if you go down to more local communities that are highly dependent on irrigated agriculture, the numbers will be quite drastic. And I think I note the basin says the authority believes there is an urgent need to undertake a comprehensive assessment of social and economic impacts at a community and industry level. And I'd endorse that, because I think, contrary to what Mike said, there's been some prior analysis, for example, for the Cotton Research and Development Corporation, which said a 25% cut, this is by Judith Stubbs and Associate, would result in a 14,000 loss of jobs from irrigation communities. Now, that's the, you know, getting those numbers right and understanding that impact is obviously quite important. For a whole range of reasons, not the least being the politics of being able to sustain the plan.
Well, irrigators and politicians are saying that the cuts will devastate many communities. Is that the case?
Look, cuts of this size on the surface, I think, would. I mean, one of the dilemmas is that a lot of irrigators have become much more efficient over recent years, and are therefore at a point where to find further efficiencies is going to be quite difficult. There's some sense from the comments being made that, well, this will mean water will drift to higher value uses, things like horticulture and wine grapes. But as we've seen at the moment, they're not necessarily higher value uses, but they are high capital uses. You've got to put a lot of money into the ground to get those efficient irrigation systems working. And then, of course, if you face a reduction in water, you're quite vulnerable, because you've probably had to take on debt to put that infrastructure in place. Whereas cotton and rice, for example, are, I suppose, catch-as-you-can type crops. They only grow annually. They're only planted when the water's available, and therefore the farms running or using those sort of productions are probably much more resilient, because they've got other enterprises. So I think the simplistic assumption that the water will simply drift to higher value uses and therefore will result in greater economic activity and therefore the economic impacts won't be as great just don't necessarily fall out in practice.
Professor Mike Young, Mick Keogh is disputing the idea that there will be this sort of innovation and increased efficiency which will lead long-term to not too great an impact.
Certainly the global experience has been that you do get a lot of innovation when you go through these types of structural adjustments and these changes. I think it would be a real mistake if we only debate the numbers and the impacts, because there's a lot of opportunity for policy innovation here. And the really important thing for everybody to think through is whether or not this proposed new framework is right, whether or not sustainable diversion limits are specified the right way. It's very important to look behind the averages to work out how much water this means you'll receive in a dry year as compared with a wet year, and understand the distributions that are in there. Very important to understand how environmental water is going to be managed, where the benefits are going to go. One of the things which is very clear is the lower limit is enough just to get the basics of the river functioning. When you go past that, there are going to be massive community benefits, which will flow through to regions and communities through increased tourism, recreation and all those things. Weighing all that up has to be included in the calculus. I agree with Mick, the detailed assessment has to be done, and that's part of the process. What's really impressive is that the authority under the Act is not required to release the document it's released. It could have just released a plan. It decided it was so important for the community to have a debate and for businesses to understand where they fit in all this process that it would release a guide and go through this extra consultation process to make sure the numbers they're using are right, the concepts they're using are right, and importantly, the speed of the transition is appropriate. We could do a lot of harm by going too fast or too slow with this.
Do you think that the people who drafted the plan got it right?
When I look at the plan, and I've had a lot of involvement overseas in these sorts of processes, it's consistent with international best practice. You can argue over the detail, but that's part of the process we need to go forward. I'm impressed by where we've got to, impressed by the numbers, and impressed by the authority's commitment to making all of the background information available. That's going to make it hard for people. There's just so much documentation about to come out. Somehow we have to focus on the big questions, the big issues, particularly things like whether or not the relationship between ground and surface water users is correct. When I look at it quickly, I think there's too much pressure on surface water irrigators and not enough on groundwater irrigators, and it's very important to get that right. When I look at the role that forestry, farm dams, overland flows take, it seems to me obvious that they should be included in part of the adjustment process, not left as the basin or Axial Authority suggests might be to something where those people are protected.
Mick Keogh, what do you reckon? Have the people who've drafted this plan, have they got it right?
Look, I think it's important to understand right from the start that they drafted this plan in accordance with the requirements of the Water Act 2007 that was legislated by the Howard government. So you have to understand that the authority is operating within that framework. In other words, the legislation tells it what it can and can't do. And I think that's where the problem lies, because, of course, Section 4 of that spells out exactly what they are allowed to do, and that is they have to restore the basin to what's called an environmental sustainable level of take. And that means that they have to first and foremost make some judgment about how much extra water is needed to restore the environment. And then, after they've done that, they're allowed to look at what the best way is to use the rest of the water to maximise social and economic outcomes. So there's no doubt that bit of legislation gives them a very narrow focus. And I guess the Basin Authority has had that constraint very clearly in front of it, and that's what they've done. I think the biggest disappointment is that, once again, we're not seeing any detailed monitoring proposals to judge whether, in fact, what's happening in terms of extra water for the environment is having the desired effect. I think most water scientists would agree that over the years, governments have been big on headline policy decisions about allocations, but very niggardly when it comes to putting in the sufficient science and monitoring to actually understand what's happening, to make some judgments about whether it is 3,000 gigalitres, 7,000 gigalitres, or in fact 1,000 gigalitres that might be able to achieve the outcomes that you want. And, you know, I think it's almost symptomatic that the Basin Authority comes out with an assessment that they need somewhere between 3,000 and 7,000 gigalitres. That's how, rule of thumb, if you like, the science is, and yet we're spending an awful lot of money and an awful lot of economic impact without really knowing whether, in fact, we're achieving much for the environment. And I think that's the real disappointment in this whole plan.
So you think that the environmental, the environmental benchmarks need to be spelled out more clearly?
Well, they're not spelled out at all. I guess the wording of the plan is we'll see an improvement, but how do we know that? We don't have indicators agreed, for example, that would be used to assess performance. We've spent an awful lot of money buying back 655 gigalitres in the current plan. And again, we don't have any indicators or agreement from water scientists about what we should look towards in the future as a good measure of whether that money that's been spent on all that water is actually achieving a good environmental outcome.
Professor Mike Young, do you agree?
Well, when I read the plan and I look at the description of the environmental impacts, I see probability impacts being talked about. And the 7,000 gigalitres is sufficient, they say, to deliver all the outcomes that were required in across the system with almost complete certainty. If you go down to 3,000 the other end, then the probabilities of achieving the outcomes tend to be in places like South Australia, around 56% going through into New South Wales, 53%, 75%, 62% in Victoria. So there's some real attempts to quantify this in a summary way. There's a lot of background data behind it. What I think this says is that if we go for a lower number, then we're going to have to be very, very clever in the way the available environmental water is managed and putting all those arrangements in place. The framework the authorities put in place, as I said earlier, is really to start by having a river that flows to the sea on a regular basis. That's a very, very simple criterion. And what they've said is at the moment, 3.5 years out of 10, the river fails the most basic of tests. It doesn't flow to the sea.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Economist Professor Mike Young, Executive Director of the Environment Institute at the University of Tasmania, and Mick Keogh, Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. Thank you both very much for speaking with the National Interest.